Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcus Stanley of Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about why his group supports breaking up the nation's largest banks to avert future financial crises. Swapna Reddy of the Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School, who explains why a coalition of national groups are challenging the government's recent deportation of Central American refugees. And Jeremy Veron of the group Witness Against Torture, who discusses the recent protest at the White House demanding the shutdown of the U.S. Guantanamo prison camp that opened 14 years ago. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A surge in gang violence in El Salvador contributed to a 70% rise in violent crime in 2015, making it the bloodiest year since the Central American nation ended its civil war over 20 years ago. Last year, over 6,600 people were killed in El Salvador, surpassing the number of murders in other dangerous Latin American countries such as Honduras and Venezuela. The current spike in violence is attributed to the end of a ceasefire between two powerful street gangs, Calle 18 and Mara Salvatrucha 13. The Guardian newspaper reports gang members were also targeted for extrajudicial killings by the police. Leftist President Salvador Sanchez Seren has taken a hard line against the gangs and moved gang leaders into high-security prisons. A peace agreement in 1992 allowed leftist rebels to disarm and return to politics. An amnesty went into effect immediately, and no war crimes charges were brought against either government soldiers or rebels. In recent days, however, El Salvador has agreed to cooperate in the arrest of 17 former soldiers implicated in the 1989 murder of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter. Investigations of 1980s atrocities, including the brutal massacre at El Mazote, have reopened deep wounds and led to an effort to revoke the amnesty law. 5 years ago, New York labor activist Renan Salgado received a phone call about five Mexican migrants who were trafficked to work as food vendors at the New York State Fair. The migrants were forced to live in a bug-infested trailer and paid a sub-minimum wage. After a court fight, the Worker Justice Center obtained back wages for the workers. Salgado recently told the Christian Science Monitor, "The case really showed how connected trafficking is to the frame of our economy." Migrants, often recruited overseas with the promise of a good-paying job, travel to the U.S. with temporary work permits. But working conditions in the U.S. can be harsh, and employers often threaten to report undocumented workers to immigration officials if they complain or quit. A 2014 report by the Urban Institute found 71% of trafficked workers had been given a government guest worker visa through their employers. In the tomato fields of southwest Florida, human rights activists and groups like the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have fought to end the worst abuses of labor trafficking in an area known as Ground Zero for human slavery in the U.S. Big box stores like Walmart and fast food restaurant chains, including Yum Brands, now require food suppliers to submit clean labor audits. And for the first time, agricultural companies have agreed to provide their workers shade tents in the fields, mandatory water and bathroom breaks, and a penny-a-pound bonus for tomato pickers. Farm worker advocates are currently pushing further for Fair Food Program labels that let consumers know that produce sold is grown and packed ethically, free from labor abuses. U.S. factories have used assembly line robots for 50 years, which has led to decades of labor anxiety. New innovation in robotics, artificial intelligence, and computer power is expanding quickly and reigniting the fear of losing massive numbers of blue-collar jobs. Still, most economists say major job losses cannot be blamed on robotics or automation. By 2000, U.S. industry was operating over 100,000 robots in factories, yet the overall manufacturing workforce remained stable with 18 million workers. Steep job losses were only seen after China joined the global economy and became the workshop for the world. Economist Danny Roderick of the Institute for Advanced Study says that slow job growth since the Great Recession can be attributed to weak consumer and business spending, not new technologies. Yet researchers at Oxford University say robots remain a threat to low-skilled workers, the same group of people who have the most difficulty securing new employment. While some blame rising inequality on the rise of new tech industries, progressive economist Dean Baker instead maintains that misguided public policy that encourages financial sector growth and suppression of the minimum wage are major factors in the growing gap between the rich and poor. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, independent senator of Vermont, has long supported legislation that would break up America's largest banks, a measure also backed by Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren and other progressive legislators and economists. As he campaigns to win the Democratic Party nomination, Sanders says we must break up too-big-to-fail financial institutions. Those institutions received a $700 billion bailout from U.S. taxpayers and more than $16 trillion in virtually zero-interest loans from the Federal Reserve. He maintains these institutions have acquired too much economic and political power, endangering our economy and our political process. Many economists assert that 1999 legislation, supported by Democratic President Bill Clinton and congressional Republicans, that deregulated the nation's big banks, contributed to the 2008 financial crisis that triggered the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Among the laws scrapped under the 1999 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act were the 1933 Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial and investment banking. Today, Bernie Sanders' candidacy is focusing renewed public attention on proposals to impose tougher regulations on big banks and Wall Street, measures that public opinion polls find receive strong bipartisan support. Your reporter spoke with Marcus Stanley, policy director with the group Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about why his group supports breaking up the nation's largest banks to avert future financial crises.
There's, of course, been a debate about Senator Sanders' remarks and this attempt to kind of retroactively look back to 1998 or 1999 and the details of Glass-Steagall and the details of all the deregulation that was done. I think it's more useful to look at the actual legislation that Sanders is endorsing, which is the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. And what the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, which was legislation introduced by Senators McCain and Warren, what that legislation does, it's a little bit different than the original Glass-Steagall Act, but it has the same idea, the same spirit, is it's aimed at the rise of what's been called universal banking, which is banks that essentially do everything. They're involved in every element of the financial system, from taking deposits and making loans, traditional commercial banking, to being the major dealers in the complex financial derivatives that are traded on Wall Street, to being also major dealers in securities and in bonds and the kind of toxic asset securities that help bring down the economy. They do commercial banking, investment banking, just across the board. And the rise of universal banking, it's very clear that over the decade prior to the financial crisis, there was a major increase in the size of banks and in the complexity of those banks that dominated Wall Street. And these universal banks like Citibank, J.P. Morgan, I guess the combination of Bank of America and Merrill Lynch was a universal bank. They really were the banks that helped to hypercharge the crisis and made the crisis really the kind of global Great Depression level disaster that it was. The rise of these universal banks is also, I think, a big reason why the government was pushed into these bailouts, because these banks were so central to the economy and so significant that it was felt that it was just too risky to let them fail. So there was kind of almost a holdup that government was in, where these banks behaved irresponsibly, they deserved to fail, But the fear was that the economic fallout would be so catastrophic that they couldn't be permitted to fail. So cutting these big banks down to size, we think would have a lot of positive impacts. It would lessen the political power of the financial industry. It would put government in a position where you could let a bank fail and let that bank be restructured to be a healthy entity and experience the consequences of its actions. So we do support that.
Many people have written about the power of Wall Street and financial institutions in the United States to get their way in Congress through, you know, enormous amounts of campaign contributions to legislators. So you think Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and all these giant banks have the power to block publicly supported move to break up the big banks?
Well, our polling consistently shows that that the public wants tougher regulation on Wall Street, and they have succeeded, I think, in, you know, Dodd-Frank did make regulation tougher, but I think the public wants to go beyond Dodd-Frank. The public wants to see still stronger regulation, and the banks have been successful in heading off those efforts in Congress so far, but they haven't been successful in rolling back Dodd-Frank. They haven't been successful in eliminating the CFPB. So we're at a bit of a stalemate in Washington in terms of the power of the big banks. They have a lot of power, but I think the public is energized and is more attentive to these issues than ever before. So it's a tough and continuing fight because there's enormous amounts of money at stake and very complex and technical rules, and the banks can fund a constant lobbying presence to hammer on all of those rules when often the general public might not even know that these battles are going on. So it is a tough fight, but I believe that the public is on the side of stronger action.
That was Marcus Stanley, policy director with the group Americans for Financial Reform. Find more analysis and commentary on measures to break up America's largest banks by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At the beginning of January, 150 immigrants who arrived in the U.S. over the past 2 years, fleeing violence in several Central American countries, were arrested after being declared eligible for deportation. These were mostly mothers and children who turned themselves in at the U.S. border, were sent to immigration jails for processing, and released to the community while awaiting hearings in immigration court to determine if their stories were credible and they would thus be eligible to remain in the U.S. In almost all cases, those picked up did not have legal representation. Rallies to protest the raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, a division of Homeland Security, have been held around the country. On January 5th and again on January 11th, a notice signed by a total of 240 groups was sent to both the U.S. Attorney General and the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, stating that many of the immigrants are disabled, as defined by the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, because they suffer from severe trauma. The notice requests that the government suspend ongoing raids pending a review to determine whether the asylum and immigration proceedings that led to these families' removal orders complied with federal disability law. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Swapna Reddy, a third-year student at Yale Law School and an intern with a Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale. Here she describes the situation many of these recently arrived immigrants find themselves in, what assistance is being offered, and the government's response to her group's request for suspension of raids and deportation.
What the letter is saying is that these families who have suffered severe trauma and have developed disabilities, including post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, and depression, are disabled as defined under the Rehabilitation Act, and the government is required to make reasonable modifications for individuals who are disabled due to this law. And so what we are asking the government to do is to make sure that it identifies families who are disabled under the Rehabilitation Act, that it provides immigration proceedings that are trauma-informed to ensure that these families have an ability to tell their stories, and that it provides counsel for refugee families who are unable to tell their stories because of the severe trauma that they've been exposed to. We are also asking the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice to take these disabilities into account before considering which families to target in raids, which often occur very early in the morning with armed guards coming into families' homes and taking children directly from their beds. They're obviously another source of significant trauma and can exacerbate symptoms. And so we're asking the government to think carefully about the disabilities that these families suffer from and to try to modify its procedures to make sure that it's giving these families a fair chance at their cases.
So what if the government doesn't respond or responds and says it disagrees with you and will proceed to arrest and deport these families? Is a lawsuit the next step?
We hope that this letter is the beginning of an ongoing process to receive modifications for these families to ensure that they are not deported back to dangerous situations for reasons outside of their control. We have not set in stone any ongoing plans because we are waiting to see how the government will respond to our requests. In the past, we have brought suit against the government for situations in which we believe the government was in violation of the law. However, we have not made any substantive plans thus far.
So, Swapna Reddy, it seems like you had no trouble getting lots of groups, hundreds of groups, to sign on to your letter. It seems like it really touched a nerve.
I mean, this really is an issue that touches on a lot of problematic areas. We're talking about thousands of Central American families. The average profile is a very young single mother with young children. Many thousands of these families have been held in immigration detention centers. So as refugees who came to the U.S. and presented themselves to border immigration officials, they were then held in jail where they had limited access to medical care. And these are many of these women and even children are victims of severe sexual violence and gang and gender-based violence. And so there really are a pretty large number of groups and issue areas that are really concerned with the treatment of these families, whether it is women's rights groups, disability rights groups, faith-based and labor groups. There's an enormous amount of intersectionality on the problems that are affecting these families.
So is the government agnostic on whether or not these people have suffered what they say they've suffered, but the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials say these immigrants just didn't follow the rules and therefore are eligible for deportation?
Yes. Well, the government, either because they believe that the families did not state a valid refugee claim or because the family simply did not show up to court or had an incompetent lawyer who didn't actually make their case fully, they are now saying that the families are eligible to be removed from the United States. And we are arguing that without reasonable modifications and without allowing families to present their cases in a way that is trauma-informed, the families have not actually had a fair shot. And just to provide two anecdotes about the strength of these families' cases, if they do have competent counsel, there was a detention center in Artesia, New Mexico, that was opened up to incarcerate many of these families. And in that context, immigration advocates took on 15 cases. They finished them through the conclusion, and they were able to win 14 of them. And the sole 15th case is on appeal currently. And in Texas, in the nation's largest family detention center, which has 2,400 beds, another student, Conchita Cruz, a professor from Columbia Law School, Elora Mukherjee, and I created a national system to ensure universal representation to every family that was forced to proceed through their entire immigration case while detained. And in that context, we did not get to choose which cases we took on. We just took every case that the government forced to go to trial in jail. And we have been able to win every single one of those cases. So we do believe that these families with competent counsel, the vast majority of them have winning claims and would be able to win their refugee status in the United States. The issue is the procedures are not trauma-informed and that these families often have incompetent or no counsel.
That was Swapna Reddy of the Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School. Find more information on recent ICE deportations and immigrant advocates' response by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A protest at the White House on January 11th marked the 14th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and demanded its closure. A broad coalition of human rights groups, including Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Code Pink, and Witness Against Torture, called on President Obama to expedite the transfer of the remaining 103 prisoners held at the facility, some of them in prison without charge or trial, after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. Many of the same activists at the recent White House protest have participated in similar actions, calling for the shutdown of Guantanamo after President Obama failed to make good on his pledge to close the prison within 1 year of taking office in January 2009. The Obama administration maintains that Republicans in Congress have blocked his initiatives to close Guantanamo, but many activists maintain that Mr. Obama could have done more. In recent interviews, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough says that the president is determined to close the prison before his presidency ends in January 2017. Activists demanding the closure of Guantanamo decry the treatment of prisoners held there, described by some human rights groups as torture, involving such methods as force-feeding and sleep deprivation. Since it opened in January 2002, 9 prisoners have died at the facility. Your reporter spoke with Jeremy Varon, an associate professor of history at New School University and a spokesperson with the group Witness Against Torture, who talks about the ongoing human rights violations at Guantanamo and the goals of the protest.
We've been gathering in Washington since, I believe, 2006, and then a robust coalition has built itself over time. We're all motivated by the same thing, the desire that the United States obey the rule of law, respect human rights, and finally close Guantanamo. This year was especially significant because we're entering the last year of Obama's presidency, and this is his last year in office. The thing he did first on his first day in office was pledge to close Guantanamo within a year, and that clearly hasn't happened for a variety of very complicated reasons. So we were saying in this rally that this is the last chance for leadership for the president. His Guantanamo policy, however well-intentioned, has been really a horrible mess. And then at the rally, I said very strongly that a portion of his administration will end in disgrace if he doesn't close the prison, whatever other good things he may have accomplished. And then I said also that that might sound like a harsh judgment, but it's a standard set by the Constitution to which he pledged allegiance, and then his own words in which he declared torture un-American. And then if he has this conviction, he needs to demonstrate the courage of his conviction, push past congressional obstacles, which are very real, push past public opinion obstacles, which are very real, and do the right thing for the right reasons at last.
Jeremy, list for our audience some of the violations of human rights as well as international law that you see as being crossed in Guantanamo all these years.
I mean, sure. I mean, one is that, you know, torture of various forms, physical and psychological, was practiced at Guantanamo, was practiced in other places, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, black sites in Afghanistan, in Europe, in parts of Asia. But some of the notorious torture techniques were used there, beating people's heads against walls, you know, brutal physical beatings. People have had bones broken, you know, severe concussions, et cetera. And then a whole slew of psychological torture, exposure to intense cold, intense heat, the constant playing of music, being kept up for days on end, and then the practice of force feeding for those prisoners who resist through hunger strike. And then to be force fed is to have plastic tubes rammed down your nasal passage into your stomach, and it's very, very unpleasant, and they often do it in a particularly brutal way. So, you know, one thing is that it violated common sense standards of the prohibition against torture. And then initially they claimed that these people had no rights under any system of law whatsoever, not U.S. federal law, not the Geneva Conventions, not the International Convention Against Torture, because the claim is that they were enemy combatants, an entirely novel kind of combatant not covered by any of these agreements. And then their status was litigated for years, and there were many very important Supreme Court cases that sort of won back to the detainees some rights that the Bush administration had tried to strip. But sadly, the grant of those rights hasn't materially affected the circumstances for a lot of men there. And then the main thing here is that they were granted the ability to file a writ of habeas corpus and then challenge their detention in federal courts. And then some men won their hearings, but the courts didn't have the power to order the military to release them, or the government kept appealing and then wound up with a standard for these rulings that is so preposterously favorable to the government that it became hard to to win these rulings. And then we consider, you know, indefinite detention without charge or trial for men who the government admits pose no security threat to be a form of torment, if not a form of torture, and certainly something we should be ashamed of. And right now, 44 men have been officially cleared for release by the government, and then many, many more could be safely resettled.
What were some of the specific demands that this coalition of groups brought to the White House with them on this 14th anniversary of Guantanamo opening its doors?
Right. I mean, the core demand is essentially unchanging, close Guantanamo, you know, and then within that, at a more policy level, Obama could expedite the transfer of people cleared for release. And there was some recent reporting talking about what an obstacle the Pentagon has presented for a variety of reasons. So sort of lean more heavily on DOD to release people. And then to think about exercising executive authority to close Guantanamo by executive order if Congress doesn't agree to its closure. And then this is something that the administration has, you know, sort of vaguely threatened but never really concretized as a plan. And then another thing that we believe is that Guantanamo should close, not simply change its zip code. And then if you held on to the principle of indefinite detention without charge or trial and stuck people into a supermax federal facility somewhere in America, you would just be relocating the problem, not solving it. And then, you know, bear in mind that some of the guys who've never been charged or tried, I mean, they're not formally guilty of anything. And if you throw them into Florence, Colorado, you're putting them in barbarically austere conditions that the jailers themselves say are meant to sort of destroy the mind. So you could argue that that represents an exotic form of cruelty, that you would put people who haven't even been charged into the most restrictive prison in the United States. So the hope is that he sees this as a legacy issue and then figures out in the last, you know, 11 months or so, you know, how to make this happen, you know, as much as he reasonably can. And then the odds don't look good because it's hard to imagine Republican Congress will ever consent to a plan. But it's also important to emphasize that his administration itself has been part of the problem, and to present it as only part of the solution thwarted by the Republicans is really too favorable and an inaccurate view of things.
That was Jeremy Varon, an associate professor of history at New School University and a spokesperson with the group Witness Against Torture. For more views on the campaign to close down Guantanamo, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.